Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, July 3rd. I'm Ray Graff. Time once again for another science forum, and we welcome our panel of experts. They're back to answer your scientific inquiries. The number to call is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. If anything's bugging you, something you got, you're thinking about it. Hey, how does that work? How does this, why does this happen? These people know a lot of stuff, and they'll try to prove it coming up. You can also email voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. The Science Forum, and your calls coming up right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. It's time to reconvene the Science Forum, and we have our experts here ready to handle your questions. The number is 800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. You can email the program as well as we roll along here. voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email, and the number once again is 800-348-2551. With that, let's have our team of scientists sign in, please.
Ed Stander from SUNY Cobleskill. I will be answering questions on geology, astronomy, and anything that Barbara would be here to answer since she's not here today.
Barbara's a late scratch today, so we'll have to press on without her.
I'm Jim Pickett. I'm an organic chemist, mostly retired.
How's that working out? Good? It's nice. Just, enjoying yourself?
It's ducky. Yeah.
Really? Because we're all pretty excited. We have the long weekend ahead. And, you know, we've been working for a living. Now every day is a holiday for you, right?
Every day is a Saturday.
Oh, so you're missing the 4th of July then. You don't, nothing to it.
Yeah. And then you.
Roger Giaboni. I'm an electrical engineer, and I own a company called Rogers High Fidelity.
Can I call you Cap'n now?
You can call me Cap'n.
Oh, my gosh. I saw the article. The iBerkshires, right?
Correct.
Yeah, so you're doing tours over there on the lake, huh?
Right.
How did that come up? Just quickly, how did that come about?
Well, it's a very popular thing in Florida, and we saw a need for it in the Berkshires. There is none. It's a wonderful way to see the lake. A lot of people don't want to drive a boat. They want to go out on a boat, but they don't necessarily want to take the responsibility of driving the boat. And starting next year, the state of Massachusetts requires that you have a boating license, which is not for the faint of heart. It's 3 days.
It's a 25-ton boat.
Not the master's. I have a Coast Guard master's license, but Massachusetts will require a boating license, which is a course that is 3 days, 3 hours a day.
Right.
So it's not for the faint of heart.
Well, good for you. You know, I've been on that boat. It's pretty cool, man. So
thank you.
Good luck with that.
Thank you.
All right. Now, let's go to the geologist here first. And by the way, if you have a science question, 800-348-2551. This one's for Ed. I saw this, and this was actually big news way back when in last week. Scientists have identified what could be the oldest rocks on Earth from a rock formation in northern Quebec, long known for its ancient rocks. The researchers disagree exactly how old they are, though. Samples from the new site place the rocks about 4.16 billion years old. Pretty old, Ed. How do they date those rocks? And is this important news to people like you?
Well, it's important news because it's considered the oldest rocks. And it's during a period of time when we thought that the Earth was pretty well molten.
Ah.
And so these would be the first rocks to have cooled after the Earth started to cool, effectively. And the only rocks that we have of that age is called the Hadrian period, and it ended about 500 million years after the Earth formed.
Did they have to dig deep to get these rocks?
That's one of the problems, is that most of the old rocks are at the bottom. And unless you can dig that far down, you're not going to find them. So the fact that they're at the surface is really good news. Now, as far as dating the rocks.
Yeah.
Dating the rocks. You can use a number of ways of determining it, but mostly it's radiometric dating. In this case, what they did is two things. First of all, the rocks that they were looking at, which is sort of a granite-type material, was between lava flows.
Okay.
And lava flows very often contain little crystals of zircon, and zircon contains uranium at times. And if it does, then you can use that uranium to determine how old the zircon is, because it goes from uranium to lead over a period of time.
Ah.
And unfortunately, in the Earth, there is so much lead that generally speaking, unless you can prove the lead came from uranium, you can't get a date like that. So zircons are one of the few ways that you can actually get a date. So you find a zircon, you determine how much uranium, how much lead there is in it, and that'll give you an idea of how old it is. If half the uranium is turned into lead, the rock is about 4.5 billion years old.
Wow.
Okay, so that was one way. But in terms of this granitoid, it didn't have that. So they used a different system. They used samarium turning into neodymium. And yeah, exactly.
It's easy for you to say.
Exactly. And in order to get the half-life of that, it takes not 4.5 billion years, it takes almost 100 billion years. So over the age of those rocks, not much samarium is turned into neodymium. So it's a difficult thing to get a very good date on, a very precise date. So the lava flows tell us that it's older than about 4 billion years. The rocks themselves, using samarium neodymium, seem to suggest it's about 4.1 billion years.
Now, is this a big deal?
Well, if you want a rock, if you want an old rock, it's the best
right.
stuff around.
All right. But you said, now, what is the Earth? About 4.5 billion years old.
About 4.5 billion years
okay.
old.
Okay. And you said at that time it was thought to be molten. Does
right.
this change our timeline?
Doesn't change the timeline. It tells us that by about 500 million years or 450 million years of the age of the Earth, that rocks were starting to form. And there's no problem with that.
Okay.
And being this rock was found on the surface, how did they know it didn't come from outer space?
Well, because there's a huge amount of it, first of all.
Oh.
Second
it,
of all,
it wasn't
got,
an individual's.
No. It's a huge area. It's a green. It's called a greenstone belt.
Okay.
And first of all, it was very big area. Second of all, it has these lava flows going through it. So it must have come up from down below. But the trick is that that area, which is called the Canadian Shield, especially that area, contains the oldest rocks. We know that.
I read that.
This is just a case where they've been able to date the bloody things to get some idea of what's going on.
The number here is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. If you have a science question,
yes, sir.
You can also email the program at voxpop@wamc.org. Nick wrote in earlier another rock question. In general, do some types of rocks absorb water? Are they noticeably heavier after rain?
Well, there are rocks that absorb water. There are also rocks that absorb smells. The rocks absorb all sorts of things.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Well, the best example of rocks that absorb water are mostly volcanic. For example, there's a clay called illite, which can harden up, and it absorbs quite a bit of water. Mount Marillionite as well. In fact, Mount Marillionite absorbs water. If you take a piece of it and stick it on your tongue, it'll stick to your tongue.
Really?
Because it's taking water off
your
tongue.
Should you probably not do that?
I don't think it's a good idea.
But you've done it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
And then there's things like zeolites, which have a sort of an open structure, and they can capture all sorts of things. In fact, they used to feed them with chickens to make their, excrement not smell.
Oh.
Yep.
Wow. Something I didn't need to know. Ed Stander, Roger Jaboney, and Jim Pickett with us today on the Science Forum. Now, Jim, we talked about this briefly before you came in, and I saw this in the news. They have found another interstellar visitor.
Yeah, I know very little about this. It was only a couple of days ago, I think,
yeah.
that it was discovered. But yeah, I mean, I think that this is really cool because it indicates that there's a gazillion of these.
A gazillion?
Never, yeah, exactly.
It's a scientific
term. One gazillion.
That's okay.
Because we've found three now in relatively short order. So
it's not that big of a deal. We're just now being able to find them.
Yeah.
And how did we find this one?
I think just with an optical telescope.
Right.
To find it and seeing that it. Finding a spot that moves over the course of several days
right.
or weeks.
I thought I had seen something about a system of planetary defense telescopes, which
right.
I've never heard of.
Yeah, they used to blink plates back in the time of photography. They take a picture of an area, and then they take another picture a week later, and then have one light up and then the other one light up, so you'd see both of them coming at you at the same time, and you'd see something move, and that's how they would find it. And what these telescopes do now is they effectively take the photograph and they analyze it real time. And if something is moving, then they mark it as being found. And from that, by measuring over a period of time, they figure out what its orbit is. and can figure out what it's doing.
I was going to say, it's the same way we track satellites.
Is this system, this so-called planetary defense telescope system, is this new?
No. In fact, there's one, you can actually buy a used one on eBay right now for about $500.
Really?
Yeah. They work very, very fast, and of course they don't give you the software to run it.
Oh.
But basically, they work very, very fast, and they analyze the data very fast because they want to know if something's coming in.
And they have tracked a lot of these distant objects that are in orbit and potentially could collide with us. That's what this is all about?
No, I think this is more about tracking things that may be coming from foreign nations that we don't want to have towards us. Yeah, but at the same time, it also takes pictures at night, and you can use that data to analyze to see other things.
Interesting. Roger, you mentioned, Roger Giboni, you mentioned tracking satellites.
Correct.
And here's something I've always wanted to know. You can't optically track a satellite in daylight, can you? If your telescope is really good, can you do that?
I don't know the answer to that. I would imagine you could. I would imagine you could with the appropriate filters. I would imagine that you could.
Yeah, well,
I would bet you could see the International Space Station.
Yeah. Oh, I have seen the International
Station. In daytime?
In the daytime.
No, in the daytime.
Yeah.
Because it's bright enough. But
I've actually spoken with him on 2 meter FM.
Oh, you mean on ham radio?
Yeah.
Ah, understand. All right, let's take a quick break here. 800-348-2551. Science Forum today. We are just getting rolling. And we have Ed Stander, Roger Giboni, and Jim Pickett. Please call if you wish. We'll be back. Whoops. Sorry, Zach. I was adjusting my mic when you opened it up. Yeah, okay. Well, you know what? I'm losing my touch here. 800-348-2551. Never touch the mic boom when you're on mic. And that's on me. It's not on Zach. It's the Science Forum today with Ed Stander and Roger Giboni and Jim Pickett. Jim, did you have homework for this program?
No, but there's something more I wanted to talk about.
Oh, what is that?
And that segues in nicely from the previous one. And that's the Vera Rubin Observatory that just came online in northern Chile.
I have most of her albums.
Yeah. What this is about is that it is an extremely huge detector on the telescope. The largest digital camera in the world is what it's billed as. So it can take a very wide field of view. It can see a square that's five times the diameter of the moon.
Wow!
In size, for
all
a
at
shot.
Once, amazing.
And it's designed to take the data very quickly, so it can scan the entire sky that it can see every 4 days.
Wow!
So what it's really designed for is to see things that change, like we discussed.
Yeah.
So things that move, things that change brightness, and it'll be cranking out terabytes of data for astronomers to pore over.
You know, you make a great point about terabytes of data. It must be lots of megapixels in this, and there's a lot of data. This would not have been possible even 5 or 10 years ago, right?
No.
Because the processing power required to do this.
That's right. It's really that kind of information processing technology that makes this possible. So it's expected to find something like 90,000 new near-Earth asteroids, near-Earth objects. It'll find 200 million stars in the galactic halo. These are stars that are just kind of hanging out around the main disk of the
Milky Way. These are stars that the Hubble or the Webb can't see? I mean, those are advanced and telescopes that are far out there.
Yeah, I mean, they can see, they could pick them out one at a time. But as far as finding these wholesale This is what this observatory is intended to do.
And it's too bad for amateur astronomers, I might add.
Why is that?
Well, it turns out that the only thing that amateur astronomers can name by themselves are asteroids.
Oh, really?
Yes. For example, if you look at the back of a magazine and it says, name a star after your girlfriend,
yeah,
all they do is they open up a book, and for $40, they'll open up this book and they'll write your name next to the asteroid,
right,
and then they'll close it. Yeah. So nobody even knows about it. But if you discover an asteroid and you discover what its orbit is, you can name it after yourself or after your mother.
How about supernovas? They can't name supernovas after
them? They name supernovas like 1987B.
Because I have a friend that found a supernova.
Really?
In his own, yeah, with a personal telescope. Sorry.
That's okay.
And I thought they named it for him, but maybe not.
No. The asteroid's the only thing you can do it. So, for example, there's an asteroid out there called Zappa Frank.
Really?
Yeah. Named after some spatial wanderer.
Yeah, how about that? The number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum. Let's go to Hudson. Austin, you're on.
Hey there. Thanks for having me. So I saw an article recently about the possibility of there being a three-dimensional time, putting us in time and space in six dimensions. It's, particle time, quantum time, particle time, and then gravitational wave time. I was just wondering if there's any merit to this, or is this really exciting release stuff, or is this more like an anthropologist talking about Bigfoot again or something? I'm just wondering what you guys think about this.
In fact, I recently saw one of the YouTube channels that I follow is Sabina Hassenfelder, who's a physicist. And she was rather incensed about all of this. It is utter total nonsense.
Really?
In the sense that there's no need for it. I mean, you could postulate as many dimensions as you want, but
I mean, there's no need for anything when you get right down to it. But can you test something like that?
No,
can you falsify it?
No. I mean, well, you falsify it in the sense that one dimension of time works just fine. So if there are other dimensions, they don't matter.
Go ahead, Austin.
Sorry about that. I was told the argument was that it could possibly one day lead to a gravitational unified theory. Is there any merit there, do you think, on like the 20-year scale of, you know, leading down a rabbit hole of research, or is this really changing nothing?
Well, according to Sabina Hassenfelder, it's nonsense.
Awesome. Thank you so much, y'all.
So anyway, I would advise you to look at that YouTube channel.
If
you Google Sabina, S-A-B-I-N-E, you'll find her.
Yeah, it doesn't take a lot of time to watch.
Okay. So you're skeptical,
then. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks a lot, Austin. I guess I won't get into string theory, then.
No,
you're also all right. John writes in, I wrote in a couple of years ago about my bird feeder ending up with the sunflower seed all ending up on one side of the cylindrical feeder and the millet sides on the other. Nobody on the panel could explain it. I have observed it closely since then, and it's happening as the seed pours out of a container and into the feeder. Couldn't this be a type of fluid dynamics? And that's from John.
It could be. It could also be static. When you put things down through a plastic container, it can attract certain things in one direction or another.
Yeah.
Or a charge, yeah. Negative charge, positive charge.
Yeah, we did talk about this on the air at one point, because I remember this distinctly. What it can also be is what's called the Brazil nut effect.
Right.
What?
In which if you take a can of mixed nuts and shake it, the Brazil nuts will rise to the top.
Even though they're bigger.
They will segregate. And that's because when there's this random energy going in, things move around and little objects can get under big objects. So my guess is that something in this flow is doing something similar, in which the small millet seeds can get under the sunflower
the trouble
seeds
is and not segregate. Under, it's one side.
It's one side.
Other.
Yeah, it's one side.
Yeah, the one side just I have a hard time.
So
with that
negates
one.
The Brazil nut effect.
Well,
because
there's still something that's driving that, but what the force is that goes laterally That I don't know.
I know, John.
The concept that a squirrel likes one seed over the other and is getting them over on one side.
Yeah, except that he's watching it actually happen. So there's no squirrel watching it, I guess.
Well, I know, John, and the Brazil nut effect would apply since he's sort of a nut. You know, the number
here. Is he from
Brazil? I don't know. 800-348-2551 if you have a similarly interesting science question for our panel today. And, you know, it's summer, 4th of July. People are not calling in at this point. Yeah. So, Ed, say something.
Hi.
Well, go ahead. Having to do, again, with kind of segueing from the Brazil nut effect.
Yes.
How boulders over time, but when there's, will appear in farmers' fields.
That's the ice effect.
Yes.
Right. In fact, there was just a study done about 2 years ago. I wish I had done it because it was simple. And what they did is they took a plate with different soils on it, and they froze it, and they defrosted it, and froze it, and defrosted it over and over again.
Mm.
And what happens is the between the crystals, between the grains of material, you get capillary effect from the water, and the water forms columns. And you've probably ever been in the woods?
Me?
During winter? Yeah.
I've been in the woods, sure.
Yeah, and you're actually walking on ice crystals?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, the stuff pops up. Well, it turns out that if there's a slope, the crystals will curve, and as a result, the little pieces of rock that sit on the top will curve downslope a little bit each time, and so they'll start effectively moving from the center of an area to the edges, and you get what's called polygons forming from this material. Yep.
Seen
it many times.
Go ahead.
But it is the bane of farmers, because if you pick your field clean of rocks in another 10 years, there'll be rocks all over.
10 weeks.
Yeah.
Well, it's really good for it's really good for finding arrowheads, too.
Yes.
The number here is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. Ed Stander, Roger Jaboney, and Jim Pickett discussing the Brazil nut effect and whatnot. We'd love to hear from you. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org if you have a science question about nuts. Or actually, John wrote back and said it wasn't static. So.
Oh, okay. Well, throw it at me. Go ahead.
All right, go ahead.
Yes, yeah, static. Of course it's static. If it's not static, it doesn't have to be static. But the trick is that when the nuts fall down against a plastic, then you'll get a static charge forming. And I'm not quite sure how we could tell that there wasn't any static
right.
there.
Right, that's my question. How would he know that they weren't charged?
Now, what he could do, if he wanted to.
All right, listening, John.
Yeah, what he could do is take a piece of tinfoil, very thin tinfoil, make a V out of it, serious, put a hook the center of that tinfoil, so the center of the V, onto a piece of wood, very thin piece of wood, hold it next to the next to it when you pour the stuff in, and see if the tinfoil is attracted to it. And if it's attracted to it, it's because it's a static charge.
Interesting. All right, let's go back to the phones here. 800-348-2551 is our number. Science Forum with Jim Pickett, Roger Jaboney, and Ed Stander. And Jeff is in Jackson, New Jersey. Jeff, you're on.
Yeah, good afternoon. I guess this is probably going to be an easy one, but I've always wished I could understand better. Why is it that when you take a plastic bag and you try to open it by rubbing at the top, it doesn't work, but when you lick your fingers, it immediately works?
Ah, I have this problem in the produce section of the grocery store almost all the time.
Yeah, can you please tell me what's actually going on there? Because I wish I understood that.
I love it.
Yeah, I don't entirely understand that myself, but that won't prevent me from speculating. What it is that before you lick your fingers are dry and not making very good contact with the plastic. And the plastic's very slippery.
Uh-huh.
So you just don't get it.
Well, did you ever shoot yourself down a slip and slide of a plastic sheet that's got water running on it?
Yeah.
And it seemed like the water makes it slippery so you can slide.
The deal is that if your water is thin enough, as it would be when you squeeze your finger against the plastic, then the water is basically a sticky molecule. It's attracted to each other. That
there's a surface tension.
That
there.
Yes, that effect predominates, and you get better gripping.
Uh-huh.
If the layer of water is too thick, then the water can flow. You get shearing, and the water flows.
Yeah, and you can see that on a window, for example.
Yeah.
If you take a little bit of water on your finger and run it down the window, you can feel the stick slipping. It'll stick and then slip, stick and then slip, stick and then slip. But if there's a lot of water, you just slide your finger right down and you lose all.
So I think it all has to do with the thickness of the water layer. When it's just right, you get that good adhesion effect.
What do you think, Jeff? Are you buying it?
I think I'll have to sleep on it. I'll just have to sleep on it. But yeah. I thank you very much.
Yeah, you got it. And by the way, Jeff, that is a classic Science Forum question. I've not heard that one on this show before. So you've got
Excellent.
It. You set a new bar. Thanks, man. Appreciate it. Have a good holiday weekend. 800-348-2551. Susan is in Sunderland, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I have a perfect follow-on question about plastic.
Splendid.
And it is about microplastics. On the morning show, Judith Enk has talked about, you know, microplastics. Every time we open a container of milk that now has a plastic cap opening it,
yeah.
that we're getting little microplastics in our food or our milk or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I just wanted to ask, because I've also heard, like, on a monthly basis, we eat a equivalent of a size of a credit card in plastic. Can your guests talk about this? And if there's any way to, like, go back to the good old days of regular milk containers, et cetera?
You know, well, I wish Barbara Brabitz was here for this one, but go ahead, fellas.
The credit card's worth of plastic thing has been pretty well debunked.
Okay.
That was an off-the-cuff thing that somebody wrote down once, and that there's no basis for
okay.
that. So that kind of quantity.
But are we getting microplastics every time we unscrew the plastic cap on the milk?
I'm skeptical of that. It just doesn't. The whole microplastic thing, number one, is that it has been repeated enough times that people assume that there's something bad about it. But I've never seen convincing evidence that it actually is. Now, it would be better not to have it than to have it, but I don't think the world's ending because there are microplastics.
Okay. The world will end soon enough anyway. Yeah.
The second thing is, I've read articles or papers on how they've analyzed the microplastics or nanoplastics. And I'm skeptical about what it is that they're actually measuring. The papers that I have read have not been entirely convincing, especially on the smallest nanoplastics things, because it's really hard to distinguish plastic from stuff which is normally in cells anyway.
Ah, interesting. So the jury's out.
Similar.
The last thing I would say is that now that I've heard this thing about opening plastic caps, when I see it, I can see there are little plastic shards when you open them, and I wipe down the cap of it with a wet paper towel to try to get rid of them. But I'm just, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's not microplastic then, if you can see them, right?
Well, by the definition of microplastic, yeah.
Okay.
But something like that that's that big is just going to pass through and not cause any.
Well, how about milk and glass bottles, you know, with a nice cardboard top on there?
Yeah, I mean, it's just...
Yeah, the old days.
Yeah, Susan.
I mean, there's always going to be dust and dirt in everything. And most of the things which qualified as microplastics is, in fact, lint.
Really?
Yeah, it's from...
So you're saying I have microplastics in my belly button?
Absolutely.
Amazing. It's the Science Forum. Ed Standers here, Roger Jaboney, Jim Pickett, and let's, mercy, Let's go on over to Connecticut, and we'll talk about string theory with Mike. Hello, Mike. You're on.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I was just wondering what you thought about Eric Weinstein and how he says that physics has been stalled since the 1970s, and whether that's purposeful or not is up to debate, and how string theory is not going anywhere. Thank you.
Okay. You want to hang in there, Mike?
Yeah, I can listen.
Okay.
There again, my authority for this is Sabina Hassenfelter. In that, yes, string theory seems to have been a dead end. It created some interesting math.
There's a great book on it.
Yeah.
Hyperspace, I think it's called.
Well, yeah, there's a gazillion. Again, that exact number again. By coincidence, one gazillion books on on string theory. And that, yes, it probably has bogged down physics.
And do you think that is diabolical or that's just natural?
Yeah, I want to get back to that, Mike, because you said, is this by design or something like that? And I'd love to find out what you mean by that.
I don't know. They always say how, you know, how when it has been stalled, that, you know, conspiracies have been thrown out there. Installed on purpose, you know.
I don't believe. Just because
I agree with you.
You can't get a room full of scientists of any kind to agree to joint action.
Are you saying they're difficult
awesome.
People?
Thank you so much.
Thanks, yeah. Man. Appreciate the call. Let's take a break.
Yeah, they could be at times. Yeah.
All right. We'll get back to that point in a moment and some emails and some more calls. 800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551. We'll be back. John Schofield here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. Ray Graff with you and the scientists are here. Jim Pickett, Ed Stander, and Roger Jaboni. This email here from Lisa. I drive the turnpike every day, and I see these bands, striations, of shiny rocks on the side of the road where they did some blasting. I think it might be mica deposits. I heard years ago about a man had this mica in his backyard, took a screwdriver, and he was finding emeralds in between these soft layers. Is this true? Can you find emeralds in this way?
Well, if you find emeralds, it's because the rock is metamorphosed. In other words, the emeralds are formed by heat and pressure on the material that was there. And mica usually forms in the same way. So it's possible to find little bits of shiny emeralds or emeralds, rubies, or sapphires are all the same material.
Right along the thruway. I've seen those striations, too.
Yeah, well, you'd have to go pretty far south to be able to see them because the rocks up this side and for almost the entire way down the thruway are sedimentary rocks. They're not going to contain that.
Interesting.
But if you get down towards the New York City area, then you're into the metamorphics.
Hmm.
And effectively, a little piece of the Appalachians comes up through there. And those rocks would contain that sort of stuff.
Very interesting. This email from Cheryl. I have three bird baths in my yard. One is ceramic, one concrete, and one is a resin material. All three are in an open area of the yard, each getting some sun, some shade. All three seem to be used equally by the birds. For some reason, the resin bird bath consistently has a lot of green algae in a short period of time. I'm wondering why the resin requires much more cleaning. And that's from Cheryl. And I see Jim looks perplexed.
Yeah, I don't have a good answer to that.
I'm going to suggest that the resin one gets warmer and therefore promotes the algae growth.
Yeah, if it is a darker color.
In particular, yes.
It could very well be black. I mean, if it's black, then I would, buy that. Because, yes, it absorbs more sunlight and it would get warmer.
All right. Well, that seems like a viable answer. Mm-hmm. All right. So that was almost a tie-in with the bird show, which was a couple of days ago.
And just one last thought. I would also speculate, and it's all speculation, but that the resin is more porous and therefore
it'll be less porous.
I'm thinking it would hold on to some of the algae in its pores, but you don't think so.
No, it's almost surely flat and shiny.
Interesting.
Because it's molded up against a steel
less porous than concrete.
Okay. Okay. So here's one very timely, Independence Day being tomorrow, from Aaron in Greenfield, Mass. Hello, scientists. Can you explain how fireworks work and how they can form specific patterns? I love it. Love it.
It's all done by major computers these days.
Well, how did the Chinese do it 1,000 years ago?
Well, basically, if you took a fireworks, one of these things they're shooting off, and take it apart, you'd see that the material in the various, it would be packed in a particular order, if you will. And those things would then shoot off at different directions. If you wanted red color, you'd use
strontium.
Iron.
Strontium, that's right, mostly strontium. If you wanted green color, use copper. And it allows you to determine which, you know, how it shoots off from the center.
What about shapes and such?
Well, the shapes are caused by the material being either thinner at that location or that the explosive material on the inside is larger. Sticker.
How much documentation and how far back does it go on pyrotechnics?
Well, it goes back to the Chinese.
Way back when, but is it written down? I mean, is there a body of scholarly work on pyrotechnics?
From what I've seen, it's all very, very hush-hush and secret to the company that makes them.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. But you can see in Chemistry and Engineering News, which I used to get regularly, there would be occasionally a graphic in there about how different shapes of fireworks are laid up. And it's a matter that there's an explosive charge in the middle on a fuse. So after it's shot out of the mortar, then there's a fuse that sets off the charge. Now you can kind of assume that the simplest case would be that you would then have a symmetric blast out of that. And now you could put secondary things around
it. I see.
That are propelled out, which could also have fuses
charges on them.
So that they go off at different times to produce different.
I love fireworks. Things. I tell you, there was a few years where the powers that be in Albany County let us have little ground fountains and stuff. Sadly, they pulled that little joy away from, but it was so much fun. We'd have to do little firework displays on 4th of July and really good time. Bob and Dalton writes in, are microplastics able to pass through the cell membranes of a plant? If not, would vegetarianism be a way to avoid ingesting microplastics?
I am sure that there's somewhere in the literature where they found microplastics in plant cells. But there again, I go back to it is an extremely difficult analytical problem to distinguish what you're seeing on that scale.
Right.
Because it's got to be teeny tiny in order to pass through a membrane and to know what it is that is.
And a lot of the microplastics that we take in, we're taking it through the lungs. And they're through the alveoli. They're able to suck them in, and they've got to be extremely small.
Right.
Nanoplastics and things like that. But once they get into the bloodstream, then they can go wherever they want. Plants don't have quite the same geometry, if you will, in the center. They've got the stomata, but they're not dragging stuff in from the outside.
Okay. Now let's go back to our phone lines here on the Science Forum, 800-348-2551. Richard is in Rensselaer. Richard, you're on.
Yes, I'd like to know about detecting neutrinos. I presume there's some chemical at the bottom of a very, 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 very deep well. But what does the neutrino do to what that makes you say, oh, we've detected it?
Okay.
Well, back in the old days, they would detect neutrinos using water with chlorine in it.
Oh.
And what would happen is if a neutrino interacted with the chlorine, it would make it slightly radioactive. And they would become radioactive argon, and then they would clean the water out and measure how much radioactivity there was to determine it. Later on, they discovered that if a neutrino hits a bit of distilled water, that it'll make a slight flash. And if you're really, really deep into the earth and you've got tanks with lots of photocells around them, you can actually see those flashes. And then more recently, they decided to go to Antarctica and put tubes of photocells down in the ice, a kilometer or 2 kilometers down, and make a huge, huge effectively tank where they would be picking it up during the Antarctic winter.
And what'd they find?
And they found the same thing, that sometimes these things would come in and they would make a slight flash and you'd pick it up with the photosensors.
And they detected some extraordinarily high energy.
Yes, they have.
Neutrinos that are difficult to explain. There are also a detector array that's just been put in the Mediterranean that does the same thing.
Richard, thanks for the call. Why are scientists concerned, not concerned in a worried way, but why are they interested in finding out more about neutrinos?
Because there's probably more neutrinos in the universe than any other form of whatever they are.
From whence do they come?
Well, they come from pretty well any reaction. Inside the sun, for example, there are reactions that occur all the time, taking two hydrogens to producing one helium. And if you measure the amount of hydrogen and the amount of helium and the amount of light that's produced by that, there's something missing. There's a little bit of energy that's missing, and that's what they call a neutrino.
And am I wrong, or do neutrinos just pass right through the Earth all the time?
Apparently they do.
Yeah. Because they're electrically neutral, they don't interact much. That's why the detectors have to be large in order to occasionally see a flash where a neutrino happens to smack into something that it reacts with.
And the big question is, do neutrinos have any mass? And if they do have any mass, even a very small smidgen of it, because there's so many of them, they can explain the so-called hidden mass of the universe.
So this was what they talk about when they talk about dark matter.
Exactly.
I don't think, though, that neutrinos are considered a major candidate for a dark matter.
At the moment, as far as I know, they haven't been dropped off the list.
Okay. Because the mass is, they're pretty sure that there is mass because apparently the neutrino can change form spontaneously as it travels. And in order to do that, it has to have mass. But the limit now on what that mass is very, very low. Mm-hmm.
What does that tell us about quantum, the little tiny quantum foam or the fizz? Is there mass there?
Gets to be a really hard question because the calculations are very wrong on what that is expected to be.
You don't like quantum, do you?
No, I love quantum.
Do you?
But there are things that are still not known.
All right. And electrons have no mass either, huh?
No, electrons have mass.
They do?
Sure.
Okay. All right. So let's just move on here. Let's go back to our phones. Greg in Courtright. Greg, you're on.
Yeah. A quick comment and then the question. The comment is the bird bath with the resin. Resin's an organic material. So I was thinking maybe microbes, you know, they could live on that resin maybe. I don't know. Maybe that's why she has the algae in the resin.
Actually, I know a little bit about this.
Okay.
Yeah, the organic nature of it. My question is, it bothered me since I was a kid. If you shine a flashlight for 1 second, and you're out in space on the space station or something, you get a little beam of light, like 187,000 miles long, I would take it. Will that beam of light just go on forever, or will it somehow get attenuated?
It, as far as physics knows now, it goes on forever.
Well, but it does get scattered and absorbed and all the intricacies that interfere with wave propagation will impact it. So eventually it will disperse to square the distance.
Well, that is...
Earth, right? Because the atmosphere would dissipate it?
Well, I mean, we can see... light from galaxies that are nearly as old as the universe itself. So say 13 billion years old. So that light has been passing through space
The energy stays out there is your point.
The beam of light I shone when I was a little kid up into the sky, it might be 60-some light years away, but still going.
Yeah, it's still going.
Okay.
That's neat. Well, now, thank you.
You got it.
Because you're not perfectly aligned to the point that it will be dispersed, so it'll become fainter and fainter and fainter.
I'm glad he brought up light beams.
The photons are still there.
Because you guys looked at me funny. I misspoke, and I said electrons have no mass. I meant photons have no mass.
Right.
How can that be? How can it be? How can it be a photon and a thing, a particle and a wave? How does that happen?
It's a name.
It's just a name.
Three martini conversation.
You got any?
And the problem comes in the word, when they assign the word particle to it, because we think of particle as a little chunk of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's not what physicists mean by particle.
What do they mean?
What they mean by particle is a little blip in a field. In this case, the electromagnetic field. That's a photon. It's not a chunk of stuff. And that's really hard.
It's a packet of energy?
It's a little packet of energy.
All right, this is a question from Christina. We only have a minute or two here. My understanding is that most satellites are no larger than a refrigerator, and they do not have lights on them. Can you explain how it is that we can see them with the naked eye in the night sky? I'd love to educate the conspiracy theorists in my life. Roger, your old man was a satellite guy. Maybe you can handle that.
I worked in the business a while, too. Well, I mean, typically, satellites are visible with the human eye because they reflect the ambient light around them, sunlight, typically. So that's what you see. And then they paint satellites different colors for different absorption qualities, or make them reflective for different absorption qualities. But the reason you see them, to answer the lady's question, is it's reflection of light, just like you see a star.
Right. And you only see them at certain times
You see them, they're high enough up that even though it's dark where you are, where they are, it's light.
Correct.
So they're able to see it.
Correct.
You know, and again, we watch the sky a lot. My wife and I are out there, not lately, but it's just been too hot.
Not much on TV.
You go out and you look, and some of these satellites have a specific green tint to them. And I wonder why that is. Are they coating the starlinks to make them less shiny, and that's what we're seeing?
That's what they're supposed to be doing, yep.
Why green, though? Todd.
Well, it's because the reason you're seeing it as green is probably because your eyes are most attuned to green colors.
All right, we have 1 minute left, and you know what? This is time for Merle. Merle, you have to make it fast. Go ahead.
Fireplace ash. How come it starts up again?
Fireplace ash. How come it starts up again? Scientists.
Because there must be unburned material in there. And that it's hot. If it was truly ash, then it can't burn anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it starts up.
Well,
and it's just a little tiny particle. You guys got to speak up a little bit.
I'm sorry, Merle. We're almost out of time here anyway, but apparently if it's fully ash, it won't reignite. Although I've had several situations where I thought it was out and closed the flue, and it wasn't out. And it was an ugly situation. All right, that's it. So it's a good story, let me tell you. We had power outage for about, this is 10, we had an ice storm.
I know.
And we had a fire to try to stay warm. And then all of a sudden, we went to a neighbor's house for a few days. I came back, and the house was full of smoke because I thought the fire, it was 24 hours, and it wasn't out.
It's because the ash on the top actually protects the stuff underneath it and keeps it hot.
Isn't that interesting? Well, listen, this is it, fellas. Thank you for being here. Support comes from Rhinebeck Artist Shops, offering fine artist materials and custom picture framing in Rhinebeck at New Paltz, serving the Hudson Valley for over 45 years. HudsonValleyArtistShops.com. And Berkshire Theater Group, presenting Out of Character, a solo show written and performed by Ariel Stachel, exploring identity, mental health, and belonging, now through July 26th, berkshiretheater.org. Thanks again to Ed Standard, Jim Pickett, and Roger Giboni for being here. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Susie Checkeye screened the calls. I'm Ray Graff. All right, no Vox Pop tomorrow. Have a very safe Independence Day. Uncle Ray is going to take a little rest now for a bit. Sarah LaDuke, Samantha Simmons will be handling the show. Maybe Ian Pickus, a few others. They're fabulous people. Be kind to them. I'll see you when I see you.